are back. I am Nagin Farsad. I almost mispronounced my own name, ladies and gentlemen. Normally, I'm the host of the podcast Fake the Nation, but today I'm helming the ship here at Midday, and I'm excited for this next segment. Melba Petillo-Beals was one of the 9 students who volunteered to integrate Central High in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. She was only 15 at the time, and oh my God, I can't even imagine having that kind of responsibility as a 15-year-old. But as a very young child, she had already begun to develop the thirst for justice, and she coupled that with a strong faith, which sustained her during that ordeal. She has written a new memoir about her early life aimed at young people called March Forward, Girl. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm so happy it brings her to the show today. Hello, Melba.
My blessing. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, my gosh. This is such a remarkable memoir, and you've actually written several memoirs about your experience aimed at adults, but this one, March Forward, Girl, is aimed at a younger audience. Why did you decide to write it?
Well, you know, Warriors, which was one of the first in the series, was written to children, but then later on adults read it, you know, parents read it, and they took it on and they started to read it, and it had a broad embrace among adults. This book I wanted to write because I wanted every child in this world to know upon birth, you are equal now.
Mm-hmm.
You are precious, you are equal, and you are a very special person in the eye of your creator. In Warriors, the first book, I had a sentence which this book explains, and it's this. Black folks aren't born knowing they're second-class citizens. No one bends over your crib and says, hey, you know what? You're a second-class citizen, and things are going to be different from you, and it's not going to work out. You're not going to be accepted. Instead, your self-esteem is stolen teaspoon by teaspoon and day by day. And that's what was happening to me, born in 1941 in Little Rock, Arkansas. By the time I was 3 years old, I knew that I was not accepted because I could watch my parents kowtow in front of white people when we went to the grocery store. And when we went downtown, they stepped off the sidewalk to let the white folks walk while they stood in the mud, right? So, in other words, from 3, 4, I knew.
Yeah.
Something's wrong here. We're unwelcome, and by the fear, every night at dusk, it's pull your shades, make like you're doing nothing, don't be sitting on the front porch, because the Klan may ride.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about, you know, your parents and your family. Was yours a remarkable family at that time? I mean, you know, your mother was getting a master's degree. Was that level of education unusual for a black woman in the South at the time?
It was very unusual. And what I now gather is that my parents were innately, I guess you call it genetically, very bright. My mother could look at you, for example, and cut a piece of paper out and make a suit.
Okay.
If you came early in the morning, she'd have it ready by the end of the day. She spoke 6 languages, ultimately.
Oh, wow.
And she was just very bright. She had unattainable memory. She had incredible memory. And I have some of that, some of that, all of that. And so I, at the time, of course, I didn't realize that, but she was a very unusual lady, not necessarily into mothering. She would say, if you cook a meal, someone will come along and eat it. If you, you know, spend a lot of time cleaning this room, it's going to get messy. But if you read a book, it's yours forever. Although my grandmother was my principal, the principal figure in my life was actually my grandmother, was into cleaning, cooking. She was a maid in White Lady's Kitchen for a dollar a day while being quite bright, while reading Shakespeare. My grandfather founded a university. And so while being reared in an educational environment, back then young ladies were not encouraged to get an education. So my grandmother ended up being a maid after her separation from my grandfather. And she would come home from her duties, and then she would be absolutely spotless at home, you know. So this is the environment I grew up in. My parents divorced when I was, I believe, 9, 8 or 9, something like that.
And, what you know, you mentioned kind of noticing injustice as early as 3 years old. What are some of the things that you saw leading up to, in the years leading up to, your momentous role in integrating the Central High School?
Well, first you need to see who I am. If I rode on a bus today, I'd remember the conversation of all the people I heard. It would come back into my memory overnight, okay? And so I remember most things I hear, and I see everything that's going on around me. I was an NBC News reporter, and they said I was really good because I am really nosy. Okay, I'm really, really, I like to collect data. It's not that I'm going to gossip.
Right.
I just want to know what's going on around me. So I was a very odd child. As I wrote this book, I figured out that I wasn't your ordinary child. By the time I was four, I said, okay, where'd I come from? They said, the stork delivered you. I said, all righty. I took my red wagon. I put it on the sidewalk. I sat in it for hours in the sun because I thought if that stork passes overhead making another delivery, and inevitably he must, I'm going to flag him down and leave because I hated to be there and be treated that way. And I knew from the beginning, you don't treat other people that way. My grandmother kept preaching to me, God loves us equally. Okay, then you let the white people be in charge from January to June. Let us take over July to December. If God loves us equally, then why are those people in charge of everything? They're in charge of everything we need. The bus, the restaurant, the groceries. Everything we need.
And why do you think that? Why do you think that your family stayed there at that time? I mean, this especially in the South at the time.
Because it's what they know. Mm-hmm. They don't know anything else. They've grown up that way, and they have no money.
Right.
My mother never, even as a school teacher with a doctorate degree, never made more than $10,000 a year in her life. My grandmother, as I told you, was a maid, $1 a day in white ladies' kitchens. My father made a fairly okay salary, but he wasn't into sharing.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am speaking to Melba Petillo-Beals, whose latest book for children is called March Forward, Girl, From Young Warrior to Little Rock Nine. Melba, you know, you talk about your neighborhood a lot in this book. You talk about there being a white milkman who delivered milk to you. Was that a potentially dangerous situation for your family to negotiate? And how did you take that as a child, witnessing these kinds of interactions and how your family had to deal with it?
Well, that's one of the things that helped to formulate my feelings, is that a couple of things. These white men, one was an insurance man and one was the milkman. Things of that nature, of course, people did come to our neighborhood. In particular, the milkman was the one that antagonized my family. My mother was very beautiful. Actually, if she walked down the street, you could not tell if she was Italian or Hawaiian or what. Who is this woman? Kind of a little bit copper skin, but gorgeous hair to her waist and beautiful features and the whole nine yards. And this white man would come to my door. Now, my father would be in the back room, and he would always just take out his shotgun, and he would put the door just ajar, and he would polish it at this point. Because this guy would flirt all over with my mother, and my mother would push him away, and he would say, you don't belong here. You're not one of these. Come with me. You're one of us. And my mother would say, no, I'm not. I'm a Negro. I am a Negro. This is where I belong. And it just got to be really ugly, because if my father had shot that man, we'd all be dead. And he knew that. And it just caused, you know, tension for, it would start at like 2 or 3 in the afternoon, it would be tension for the whole rest of the day. Mm-hmm. Dinner would be horrifying. Father would be so angry. My gosh, he'd be angry.
And was there, within your own family, a preference for lighter skin? Or in your neighborhood
there
circles?
There would always be among African Americans in that period of our history. Because if you were light-skinned, you could get away with a lot more than if you were dark-skinned. So it has some rationale. Keep in mind that during slavery, the lighter-skinned people were what? Children of the master.
Right.
And whose children would he treat better? His own children. So, of course, there was the preference for lighter skin. My brother and my mother were white-skinned, and I was not. And we would go downtown, for example, and the clerk might smile at them, or they might be able to touch something, but I could never touch anything. And all of my relatives, most of my relatives would come over, and they would bend down and squeeze me, and they would say, oh, my dear, it's just really too bad that you're not your brother and your brother's not you. He's the pretty one.
Oh, my God.
And so that went on forever.
And you did feel like things were easier for your brother navigating
the community?
Oh, there's no
question that if you were fair-skinned, they were a bit easier. Not a lot easier. But for me, easier is don't call me a nigger in the middle of the road.
Right.
You see what I mean? Your measure of easier and mine might be quite different, because living in the South as a black person at that period was terribly rough. If I look at it in hindsight, from the vision and the pedestal I sit on today as a free lady in California, there's no description of the horror of that because it attacks your person. And now, listen, it's kind of revised its profile because it says this book is from age 10 up because the profile, the theme of it is as follows. No matter what you look like, no matter who you are, you're equal. Know that from birth. You don't have to get to be equal. And I used to ask my grandmother, am I equal? And she'd say, you're equal now. We don't need to wait. But the feeling you have as an African-American when you're growing up is, as soon as these white people tell me I'm equal, welcome me into their schools, and let me walk in peace, I'll be equal.
You say in the book that you felt safe at church until you were five or so. What happened that changed that feeling?
Well, we're sitting in church and we're doing kind of, they used to have these kind of soupy prayer things where you might go on a Friday or a Saturday late and you go 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock and you carry your soup and you gather. And it was, don't forget, no nightclubs, no movies, no social outlets. So church was everything for me. And so on this particular day, I was there with my grandmother to my aunt Annie's church, and so it was a different church than my own, but still, church was anointed as the only safe place for us.
Right.
And it was a wooden building with these kind of doors on it that when you walked out of it, it had these big poles across it, and that's how you locked it. So theoretically, anybody could get in and out at any time. And so all of a sudden, we hear the back door slam. And see, it's not time yet for the back doors to slam because the sermon hasn't started, the choir isn't singing. And truthfully, during the course of that sermon and that whole singing session, prayer session, you're not going to lock those black doors. So I knew immediately when I heard the slam, something's wrong. And my grandmother sat me down immediately, and she put a hand on either side of my hips, and she said, sit still, look down at your feet, don't look up for any reason. And in marched these guys in the Klan, and they had a gun. And they picked out this guy, Mr. Harvey, who was like our handyman. I had met him a couple of times before because he'd come to the house to fix the windows and stuff, you know. And he had a little boy that we played with. And they hung him right there, right in front of all of us.
Oh, my God.
And I was so tiny that I could just see his feet waving in the air and hear the gasp of his voice.
So you,
and I thought to myself, his batteries have run out. He's not going to be very good from now on. And Grandma said, yes, that took his batteries out. In other words, she didn't talk clearly about death, but she said he will be with God, and that'll be great for him, you know.
And let's fast forward. You had these traumatizing experiences like the one at the church. Did that prepare you for the hostility you experienced walking into that high school in Little Rock?
Nothing can prepare you for not at age 15, for a direct attack on who you are. Of course, I'd been attacked from a distance by strangers, hit on because I touched a dolly. Get that little nigger girl out of this grocery store. She doesn't know how to keep her hands off things. I had all that. But when you are attacked by a mob for the first time, then you don't understand that. What does that mean? You know, I mean, why are you being attacked that way? For what am I being attacked? Are you attacking me because my skin is brown? Is that it? I'm a good person. I take baths. I have a ponytail. I have saddle shoes on. And I'm very bright. And I know I'm bright by 15. I'm making straight A's in school. And I know who I am intellectually by age 15. I know I'm brighter than most people standing around me. And I'm also psychic. And I know that. People in the church offer to give my grandmother bacon and eggs and chicken if I'll read for them. And my grandmother said, no, that's against the Bible. So I know exactly who I am. And so I know that I have value because my mother and my father and my grandmother say, the wonderful thing they would say to me is, God has your picture on his refrigerator. And he believes that you're beautiful. And they would say, God loves you. And
that's a great saying.
They would say, you know, when things would go wrong, they would say, yes, but God loves you. He created you just as you are, and he thinks you're beautiful.
Can you tell me, were you aware at the time how momentous it was that it would be this historical moment for the country for you to walk into that high school and be one of the first people to integrate?
I had no idea. People are always saying, you're a heroine. No, you weren't. No, I'm not. I blundered into that school wanting one thing. I wanted my life to be better. People said, oh, you want to marry somebody white. You want to be rich. No, 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 no. Grandma said, look, let me call you rich and see if coins jangle in your pocket. What people call you, what they think of you, has no reality.
Mm.
Only what God thinks of you is important. And that's one of the eats I had to use to go through those attacks. And everybody always says, how did you get through all that? And I say, God, that's the only thing you could possibly have.
Yeah.
I was very strong and religious, 3-4 nights a week, every Sunday. There is no excuse for not going to church. And so that was the tool that I had inside of me, which is God is with you. He's as close as your skin. You have but to reach out, and he will always be with you.
Melba, this has been so remarkable. Thank you so much for joining us. The book is called March Forward, Girl, From Young Warrior to Little Rock 9. I highly recommend it. Thank you so much for joining me today.